Blog Talk Radio.
Live videos up in the swamps of Jersey. This is Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling for a Monday, the 16th day of May. Year 2016, welcome inside on this, the night that the Western Conference Finals begin between Oklahoma City and Golden State. It's a 9 p.m. Eastern tip on TNT. It'll be Raptors-Cavs in the Eastern Conference Finals, which starts tomorrow. I believe it's tomorrow on ESPN. In the race to basically decide if we get another Warriors-Cavs series, which will be fascinating on many levels, especially because we are headed towards what I like to call LeBron's ultimatum, which is basically, hey, we're going to win this thing eventually. Here in Cleveland, I'm going to bring a title home. And is this the year with some injuries on the Golden State side and this talk that LeBron could leave, even though he's probably going to opt out again just to take advantage of the cap and the new TV deal? We shall see. Going to be eye-popping numbers-wise in the offseason, but it also could be eye-popping in terms of where LeBron goes. And then on the Oklahoma City side of things, we can't forget about them. Look, Toronto, great Game 7, great fan base up north. We the North, as I like to call them. So that's going to be a dynamite atmosphere, but I do think Cleveland's the better team. Oklahoma City, though, there's some great matchups in this series. There's some great guard play, which we'll be watching between Russell and Durant, even though Durant's not necessarily a guard, but he can come out and hit almost every shot. And then obviously the Splash Brothers with Steph and with Clay. But you look at this Oklahoma City team, this Ibaka, Westbrook, Durant core, and this could be it. There's a really viable chance, a really realistic chance that this is the end of this run, of this era, for the Durant, Westbrook, Ibaka team. And that city that has bought into everything Kevin Durant does. You look at the story over the weekend. Kevin Durant comes behind an ambulance in rush hour traffic and puts his flashers on and basically helps part the Red Sea for the ambulance to get through this rush hour traffic to get to where it had to go. That's the little things Kevin Durant does. And in a place like Oklahoma City that does not have other professional sports except for the Thunder, it gets noticed, it gets picked up, and it has obviously a huge impact. So that's the dividend play there that we always talk about with Oklahoma City, and we'll see what happens in the off season. Washington gets mentioned a lot because that's where Durant's from. We shall see what will take place here, but I do think there's a chance that they stay there in Oklahoma City because I firmly believe that is the best place for Kevin Durant to be. We're going to talk about the Players' Championship, which Jason Day won in commanding fashion. He's not going anywhere. We know that for sure. Coming up momentarily with Sean Davison. And on that note, we are going to take momentarily a commercial message, come back in 30 seconds, and talk about the Players, Jason Day, and the other things that happened on the weekend at TPC Sawgrass. And, of course, it's about to undergo some major renovations. Tomorrow, the Bulldozers come in full force. We are back in 30 seconds. This is Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling on Blog Talk Radio, the Golf News Net Radio Network, and iTunes. Here's Bob Costas.
Sometimes tough isn't enough. Lou Gehrig was baseball's Iron Man, but lost it all to ALS, a muscle-wasting disease that destroyed his skills and ended his life in just a few years. MDA has been leading the fight to vanquish ALS for decades. Truly effective treatments must be found, because the battle Lou Gehrig fought is still being waged in households across America. Call 1-800-572-1717 to learn more about what MDA is doing to strike out ALS and save lives.
We are back on Teeing It Up, and we're joined by our friend Sean Davison, one of the voices that you hear if you follow Florida State Athletics on both their campus stuff and also for ESPN3. Good afternoon, Sean.
How's it going, Jeremy?
I'm good. You were on site at Sawgrass the last couple of days, and at one point you sent me a text message which basically said, Jason Day is just ridiculous. What was most impressive to me about this win was the fact that he didn't have his A game, and he just kept grinding and scrambling and getting those key up and downs. We saw it on the front nine yesterday. We saw it at times on Saturday. And he really grinded this one out and really used every facet of his game to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people like to make comparisons between him and Tiger Woods. And whereas I've been more of the person to feel, let Jason be Jason, one of the things that does resemble Tiger Woods when Tiger Woods was in his prime is that Jason has the ability to bail himself out in one area by being so good in so many others. If he misses fairways, he still finds a way to find greens. And if he misses those greens, more often than not, he finds a way to get up and down. And even if he hits the subpar chip, his putting is so good, even if it's a 10-foot slider down the hill, he finds a way to brush that in as well. So whereas I don't typically enjoy listening to people make comparisons between the way Tiger Woods used to be against the likes of Spieth and Day and Rory and Ricky and so on and so forth today, there are ways in which you could say Day did look the way Tiger used to look. He didn't have his best stuff, but he made it work just fine.
He really did. What, you know, it's funny because he's a guy that's worked out a lot. He's built, he's muscular, he has a ton of swing speed, he drives it forever. There were two moments that stood out to me in terms of the prowess of his game. One of them was the 300-plus yard three wood on Saturday at 16, which left 202 in with an 8-iron, and then the other was the shot down 18 last night with the 2-iron. I would love those two things for my game. Is it for you that ability which impresses you the most, or is it this clutch gene that's tough to explain that impresses you the most?
I think the answer to that is yes. Because not only am I impressed with just his raw physical ability. I mean, I don't know about you, but my eight iron might go 160. It does not go 202.
Yeah.
So I mean, that alone is impressive. And I've always been impressed with how he and the likes of Tiger can get that 2-iron out there, especially Tiger with the little stinger, and hit a 2-iron about 260, 270. It just doesn't make sense. It's a game that does not equate or compute to anything that I'm capable of doing. So, yes, that's impressive. But to me, going back not even a year ago to a Jason Day who could not close, who could not get the job done in majors, who could not get the job done when it was up to him to get the job done, and really was beating his head against the wall, no more so than after the Open Championship at St. Andrews, when he had himself a chance to get into that playoff and couldn't get the putt to the hole, which is almost impossible at 18 at St. Andrews. To go from there to where we are now, winning 7 of, I believe, his last 17 events,
yeah,
and being able to close out, even without having his best stuff, in a tournament that is quote-unquote golf's fifth major, it's all impressive to me, and it all seems to be coming together, and maybe there's something that's going on between him and Tiger Woods that they're exchanging, that maybe he's got the method to Tiger's old madness, and maybe he's hit on something, I don't know. But it's all really impressive that when his game isn't very sharp, he's mentally sharp to make up the difference.
Yeah, and you touched on so much there that I think makes Jason Jason, whether it's the connection to Tiger, and Tiger talked about it today. He has been officially given a Tiger Woods nickname, which means you know you are in Tiger's circle when he gives you a nickname. His is a JD. And that, I think, has helped because here's the thing about St. Andrews last year. That was despair on the 18th green. That was not disappointment. That was utter despair. And as Jim Nance said in his call of the Canadian Open birdie putt on the 72nd hole, there was no way that was going to leave that short. He would leave that short. And I think in those 7 days when he turned around, and he said this himself last night to the Live From guys, he realized how close he was. He realized he could do it. He did it. And as you and I have talked about constantly, winning tends to breed winning. And for him, it has, because he's exploded here. He knows he can do it. He has a formula now. And I really think that we are just getting started seeing Jason win all these events on the biggest stages. Here's what I'm curious about, because you walk in the galleries at numerous PGA Tour events. How has this crowd, this fan base, the PGA Tour community taken to Jason Day? He seems extremely well-liked by his players, PGA Tour officials, the media. How have the fans who are walking those ropes feel about him?
The fans have taken to him as well. There's something about a guy that's as open and as honest as he and Spieth and a lot of these younger guys are. He wears his emotions on his sleeve, but not to the extent where he blows up and throws clubs and whatnot. But you can tell, golf can hurt you sometimes. And you can tell when he's hurt by the game. And you can also tell when he's playing really well, and it's just a lot of fun to watch. And for a guy that lets you into his life, the way a lot of people always would have wished Tiger would have, and it's so easy, especially with the family moments on 18, I think not only have people fallen in love with Jason Day, I think they've fallen in love with Dash, with Ellie, with the entire Day family. This is a guy who came from Australia, who was by large troubled youth in Australia. If it weren't for Colin Swatton essentially rescuing him from himself, who knows if we would even be talking about Jason Day at this moment. And I think just that story, the family man he's become, the way he's just open and honest and lets people in, a lot of people have taken to him. Now, what I'll say was interesting about Sawgrass is that, you know, at these big events, a lot of really knowledgeable fans come out and really do take to the atmosphere. And I don't want to say they were rooting against Jason Day, but for a while on Sunday, you could tell there was a buzz in the air about Ken Duke, a lot of the same type of buzz that was in the air about David Toms. And back when Tiger won, that was also in the air about Jeff Maggart, who put on a run. That same buzz in the air about Paul Goitis. So, I mean, yes. Was the energy not quite what it has been in particular other tournaments? You could say that. But when the final putt dropped at 18, it's sort of like whenever I guess you could make the comparison to Novak Djokovic in tennis. You know, whenever he plays on the clay and he plays against Rafa, everybody roots for Rafa because everybody loves Rafa on the clay. But if Djokovic were to beat Rafa, people will give him his due, and they'll love him too. And I think that's sort of the way it was. People were starting to fall in love with the underdog story of Ken Duke and were really rooting for him. I mean, if he made a 5-foot putt, the crowd was going nuts. But at the end of the day, they were absolutely behind Jason Day as well.
Talking to Sean Davidson here on Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling. Let's talk about Ken Duke. You were there on Saturday. We were texting as this golf course went the wrong way, when they got the setup wrong, not helped by the wind and by the low humidity. Is Ken Duke 65 the round of the year? Is that better than what Snedeker did in the winds at Torrey? Because for my money, Snedeker's round looked more difficult, and it looked better, and it obviously paid off with a victory, which might rank it higher. But I think for someone on the ground who is seeing all these putts firsthand, who was feeling the heat, feeling the wind, you may have a different opinion of this. I know the 65 is sensational. Where would you put what he did on Saturday?
Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, I saw a lot of putts. I saw a lot of golf. I did not see a lot of Ken Duke on Saturday because he teed off on the back nine first. Mm-hmm. And I like to bounce back and forth. What I find interesting is bouncing back and forth between the final groups to see the ebbs and the flows, the looks on the faces, to see how they react. I like to try to read their mental outlook, and I like to try to see what they're actually facing, because there's only so much you can see on TV when they say that somebody's got a tough lie or something. So I like to bounce back and forth. Ken Duke was nowhere on my radar, and I look at this leaderboard, and the next thing I see is that in the midst of all these people shooting 80, here's Ken Duke with a 65. Me walking the course, I had to find somewhere in the shade to sit down and just relax for a few minutes. Sawgrass has these cool benches where you sit on them. It's sort of like what you see on the sidelines of football games, where it just, it puts out all this mist and it's really nice and cool. I definitely spent a good 10 to 15 minutes on one of those benches. And Ken Duke, I say this very lovingly, he's not a Jason Day in terms of his athleticism or his fitness. We're just going to leave it there. He's not a Ricky Fowler or a Jordan Spieth or even a Jason Day in terms of age. And in 90-degree weather, in the humidity, with the greens getting away from the tournament, and with the wind at times, affecting shot selection and affecting the reaction on the greens and the way the ball is reacted in the air, it's close. Again, you mentioned Snedeker won in Torrey, and there were a lot of players that came off both courses saying that the course was flat out unplayable. I believe Ian Poulter compared playing Sawgrass to being hit with a 10-pound salmon. It's hard to compare the two. They would be tied at worst, I would think. But I might still give the edge to Snedeker, largely because I can't remember how many people shot an under par round that day, but I do know that between even par and under par, there was 13 on Sawgrass that day, and I don't recall there being as many at Torrey in that final round. I want to say there might have been 4. So I think I'll give the edge to Snedeker, but either way, I mean, you're comparing apples to oranges.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking to Sean Davidson. I want to get your thoughts on this, Sean, because you're somebody that has attended this tournament a bunch. You've been behind the scenes. You've been out there walking it. Tomorrow morning, start of the day, the bulldozers come in, tear this place apart, put down all new Tiff Eagle for the greens, which is going to be fantastic. It'll be a lot easier to manage and get the course in shape for what they want. They're going to make some tweaks to 1, 9, 11, 13, and 14, I think it is, to give some additional pin positions, especially for the members and the guests that come down there. But the big one is that number 12 is being turned into a drivable par 4. As someone who has attended this tournament before, what is your thoughts on trying to make the back 9 a little more exciting and turning 12 into a drivable par 4?
You know, when I think of 12 being drivable, I actually think of growing up when you get, those Tiger Woods video games, the EA Sports video games, and you can create, like, your superhuman that you want to be just like Tiger, and they can do all these things that are just not humanly possible. One of the things I found myself constantly able to at least try to do was drive that green on 12. And if the video game is anything like reality, it's going to be one heck of an interesting turn of events when you've got guys trying to cut over those mounds where there's all kinds of, I don't even want to think about how thick that rough is over there. And quite frankly, the public doesn't really have a whole lot of access to get over to where they would be trying to cut that part of the course off. We can walk around it, but we can't get right in the middle of it. So it brings in, I think, what all great drivable par fours do, even though it doesn't have a water hazard by the green. And it brings in that possibility that if you don't catch it just right, you could be in serious trouble, and if you make a 6, you're doing great. So I'm not opposed to turning 12 into a drivable par 4. I'm actually interested to see how it plays out and if it does actually make that back 9 more exciting, because you go from 10, which is, I'm neither here or there on 10. 11 is a reachable par 5. 12 could be a drivable par 4. 13 is an interesting par 3 with the contours the way they are. It can funnel the ball wherever they do. 14 is known as probably that toughest hole on the back, other than 17 for obvious reasons, and 18. And then you've got 15, which is another one that's neither here nor there for me. And then you've got the stadium with 16, 17, and 18, and everybody knows those holes. So I like the change in theory. I have to wait and see how it plays out.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Rex Hoggard last year reported that the change is that they're going to knock down the mounds, have a water hazard, and reposition the green, and it'll play between 270 and 330. There are very few details. I don't think anybody has actually released any kind of shape or drawing or diagram for it. But it would seem to me that if you knock down the mounds and give them an avenue to go forward, and then maybe like 16 at Doral used to be, at least give some hazard on each side, but give a feasible way to drive it up there, that this could be a very interesting risk-reward par four, which comes on the heels of 11, which I think gets overlooked a lot. But the thing that makes 11 great is that if you bail out left at 11 to try to avoid the water and that big, deep bunker, you are most of the time short-siding yourself in a really precarious lie. It's not an easy up and down. I think if they do something like that, where they cut down those mounds, give people the avenue by moving the green, and yet bring water or some other kind of hazard to create that semblance of danger, it's a very interesting setup.
Well, I mean, I like those mounds. That's the thing. As somebody who's walked around that course, what I like about those mounds is that you can't see the green at all. I like that it's blocking it out, and I like the idea of if they're going to go for it, I like the idea of them not being able to see what they're going for. You know, that makes it all the more exciting to me. Maybe that's a little bit unfair, but if you're going to put a water hazard in there, and by all means, you know, if they're going to, I'm on board. I want to see some sort of mounding that also inhibits being able to see what you're looking at. Now, I mean, there might be some that say that, you know, that might bring in too much risk, and a lot of the players aren't going to opt to do it. They're just going to take a two iron and a wedge and whatever. I like the idea of the mounds on the left. I've always liked the mounds on the left because they do block out the vision of the green for the most part. So I think either way they go about it would be fine. It's just a personal taste, and I like the mounds on the left. So that's all I've really got on that.
Personal taste is personal taste. We're talking to Sean Davison on Teeing It Up with Jeremy Shung. You look at this leaderboard, this final leaderboard. Kevin Chappell finished second, tied for third with Duke was Justin Thomas, Matt Kuchar, and Colt Knost. Chappell, to me, seems like a guy on the precipice to break through. This is his second time finishing second this year. He's had his chances before. He had a chance a bunch of years back at Torrey, I think it was, when Tiger won. And for me, Justin Thomas, it was reported now, and it's official, he had his sit-down with Jack Nicklaus, which he had been talking about, and apparently it helped him make a difference. And here's a guy with all the talent in the world. You and I both know it. He got the breakthrough win overseas late last year, but has really struggled since. He is the guy in that class of 2011 known as the, you know, good buddy of Jordan Spieth, hashtag JSGB, as it's called. You know, he seems so close, so close, so close to having that second win, and maybe meeting with Jack is what ultimately does it for him.
Well, I think it's interesting how not only is he close friends with Jordan Spieth, he's also good buddies with Ricky Fowler. And when you mentioned Spieth and Fowler, those are two guys who, well, Fowler didn't win early. Spieth won early. But those are guys who had extended breaks between win number one and win number two. And to an extent, even though Fowler had the longest drought between the two, we don't know about Thomas. And Spieth answered the questions within, what, about a year or so? We all wondered, what's wrong? What's the deal? Why can't they put four rounds of golf together? And for Justin Thomas, it's not necessarily been not being able to make putts on Sunday as much as there's just one round of golf that just doesn't fit in with the others. He'll shoot 68, 67, 69, and 76. And that 76 is what keeps him two shots out of a playoff. And, I mean, it just routinely, it's that one round that just can't seem to get over the hump. He got over the hump in Malaysia. And I think he's close to doing so again. I think Kevin Chappell, in a lot of ways, could be like Jason Day in the respect, not that he's going to win a whole bunch. He could, but he has been very open, and you can tell how much frustration and despair there is on that guy's shoulders every time he comes up close and can't quite get the job done. He's trying to break through for the first time, and I think once he does, as you and I have said time and time again, winning breeds winning, and he'll figure out how to win more and more often. And there's a chance Kevin Chappell could win a major. The way that these majors have been so wide open, you know, there's a chance he could win a major or two at some point in his career. He's got to figure out how to win, and it seems like he's getting closer. Thomas is getting closer to win number two. Ken Duke might be getting closer to winning another tournament and being the ultimate Cinderella at some point. It's the beauty of the PGA Tour right now.
Yeah. I'm talking with Sean Davidson. Jordan Spieth, he misses the cut. Oh, my God, people go crazy. He's going to be fine. I firmly believe he's going to be fine. He said something really interesting in that presser after he mopped up his Saturday, mopped up his second round on Saturday. He said, I'm being too hard on myself, not being happy enough. I got to relax. And he worked too hard on his swing and not enough on his putting. I personally thought his putting lines did not look square to each other, which is a really simple fix once you get it on video and you can look at it. To me, I still think he's going to be fine. True or false, am I right?
I think you're true. I think the big thing for Jordan right now is, you know, he again, mentioning getting hurt by the game, he got hurt on the back nine at Augusta to the effect that he didn't want cameras near him because, you know, there were going to be tears and he didn't want the public to see that. I think what happens after something like that is you go back to the drawing board and you try to figure out what went wrong, how it went wrong, what you need to fix, how long it's going to take to fix it, and what you need to do. It's paralysis by analysis, and when you get so far deep into that, you mess up the simple things. And I think whether it's the lining up of the putts the way you saw it or whether the swing's still just not quite right or a combination thereof, it's still not quite there yet for Jordan Spieth. And if he can let go and move on and get back to enjoying golf the way he did a year ago, although, yes, it was easier to enjoy golf when you win the first two majors of the year, he will be fine.
I firmly believe so as well, and I think we could see it this week, hometown event. AT&T Byron Nelson at the event, he made his big appearance to the World Bomb back in 2010. I would not be surprised if he plays well this week or next week at Colonial and gets that W. Phil, he seems so close at the beginning of this year, so close. And then it's like he's slipping away again, just slipping. At Wells Fargo, it was the big numbers. He can't play the darn 18th hole. It just killed him. He made an 8 there on Saturday night after CBS goes off the air. It's just ridiculous. And to me, I wonder, we went from this eureka moment with Andrew Getson. Yes, I found it. I'm back on plane. I'm playing better. Playing now with Peter Costas showed it. And now he can't put, you know, 18 holes together. He can't put 72 holes together. He's got these lapses of concentration. Do you still think Phil is on the up of this upswing, or is he on the down of this swing?
I have no idea where Phil is. And I think that's the most frustrating but the most fun part of Phil Mickelson. We never know what that guy is going to do. He could shoot 62 one day and then turn around and shoot 78 the next. I think getting older is not helping in terms of the lapses of concentration. And I think, you know, it's been a while since he's won. Is it back since the Open Championship? He hasn't won since the Open?
Yeah, I believe so.
It's been since the Open Championship, since he's won a tournament, and he came so close at AT&T, and he might be going through a bit of paralysis by analysis. He's one of those guys that he's always into all the stats and the planes and the this and the that, and to me it seems like what he needs to do is just go out and play golf. Get yourself on a plane, you know, get your putting in order, and by and large he's gotten his putting back in order this year, and he's hitting more fairways, but just go out and play. You know, be yourself, stay true to yourself, go out and enjoy the game, enjoy the galleries the way you've always done, and let it come to you. You've won so many times in the past, you're going to figure it out again. but you don't need to put all this pressure on yourself, whether it's on Saturday or on Sunday, or, you know, you see Jason shot 63 today and you want to go low two and you know you can because you've won here before. He needs to just take a second to breathe, to remember who he is, and he needs to remember that he's more than capable of putting all this together. And I'm sure we're going to see him on the leaderboard at the U.S. Open, because I think we're due for yet another Cinderella run, and I'm sure we're going to either have our hearts broken or finally we'll get to rejoice with him. But he's a hard case to crack.
Sounds like a bunch of professional golfers need to do some yoga. Sean Davidson, as always, thanks for coming on Teeing It Up. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for Teeing It Up today. We'll see you back next week. Have a great day, buddy.